Hey, this is Pastor Bill. I am bringing you a sort of news in focus, a short article from May the 9th, 2013. Now, before you cross this out, because it's not news, it's olds, I'd just like to read the title to you. Searching for Gospel-Centered Theology Before the Reformation. This is by Gavin Ortlund. He's one of the editors of Gospel Coalition. He's the associate pastor, Sierra Madre Congregational Church, and the PhD candidate at Fuller Theological Seminary in Historical Theology. Well, I've got to tell you, I really like this program. What I mean is I like his choice of program. My latest degree is a Master's of Theology, THM, from Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary, and my chosen concentration was church history. And I would love to be able to focus that again on my next little voyage in education on something related to historical theology, and not just historical theology, but pre-Reformation historical theology. Let me just say a little bit further than this. Post-apostolic pre-Reformation historical theology. We're pretty sure the apostles had it right, and we're pretty sure the reformers, for the most part, had it right, increasingly right, but the 1400 years plus in between is what many people are unfamiliar with. If I were to give you some pre-Reformation guys that we would probably consider acceptable, I suppose Huss and Wycliffe would be near the top. Yeah, pre-Reformation. But then, you know, it kind of gets a little hazy before that, because you wonder, well, are they Catholic or are they Christian? And no, they are not one and the same. So in my own church history course that I've been teaching to juniors and seniors here at Berean Baptist Academy this year, I have been, albeit probably not the best that someone else could do, I have been doing my very best to find pre-Reformation, post-apostolic, I remember it's 1400 years, that's a big deal, people that believe what we believe. And so when I saw this article, I was thinking, boy, like 55 weeks ago, I was in a hotel room while attending the Together for the Gospel conference, working on one of the final papers that I had to do for, I think, second or third of the last projects I had to do for my THM. And that was, I was trying to figure out, did those after the apostles and before the Reformation believe in the inerrancy of Scripture? And I have that paper, and you can find it on Sermon Audio by going to our church page and then clicking on eDocs and looking for it there. It's just a list of documents. I'm the author, and you just look for the inerrancy of Scripture, pre-Reformation inerrancy of Scripture. So, onward with the article. In recent years, there has been a marked movement of evangelical converts. I started to tell you a story. So I'm at this Together for the Gospel conference last year, and I'm going from book to book at their bookstore, table to table at their bookstore, and I'm asking for pre-Reformation, post-apostolic stuff, and you got to know, there isn't much stuff on this. There isn't. And that's a conundrum, because either there were people who believed like we did, or were basically glorified Mormons. You can't have a millennium of time in church history where people didn't believe the truth, and then all of a sudden Martin Luther shows up and everything's hunky-dory, or John Huss or someone else. Now, there must have been people that believed like we did, and so my love is to find those people. In recent years, there has been a marked movement of evangelical converts to Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy. This trend has included not just younger, untrained evangelicals, but established pastors and professors, and even one president of the Evangelical Theological Society. While the causes of this phenomenon are doubtless complex and different in each individual case, one frequently cited reason is the sense of historical rootedness these traditions offer. All right, so he's opening the article by saying that there are people like us that seem to be going to Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy. Now, why? And he says, historical rootedness that these traditions offer. Thus, at the website Why I'm Catholic, one former Baptist chronicles his conversion to Roman Catholicism in terms of his parallel discovery of church history at Called to Communion. One former Presbyterian equates his acceptance of Roman Catholicism with the acceptance of historic Christianity. And at Journey to Orthodox, a website, one former Anglican describes how blessed he feels to be worshiping in direct succession with the apostles through the liturgy of the Eastern Orthodox Church. Within Protestantism also, there is a migration toward more historically rooted traditions, especially Anglicanism and the so-called Via Media. The more liturgical, historically conscious expressions of worship and spirituality. For devotional reading, most of my younger Protestant friends loved Thomas A. Kempis's The Imitation of Christ, but wouldn't be caught dead with John Eldredge's book. Hymn writing is on the rise, and many evangelicals are suddenly interested in liturgical calendar. What's causing this shift? While leaving room for the complex theological issues inevitably at play, I think one significant factor is the sense of rootlessness and restlessness many younger postmoderns feel today. At the root of my generation is a profound emptiness, a sense of isolation and disconnectedness, and consequent malaise. We're aching for the ancient and the august, for transcendence and tradition, for that which has stability and solidity and substance, and it's driving many of us out of evangelicalism. And I would just like to add an immediate counterweight to that and say, yeah, but when what you perceive to be tradition or transcendence drives home paganism and immorality, what you have is not stability. You have a need for salvation. So there's still more tweaking to be done if the new stuff that you're going to every Sunday is not producing a converted heart. So at 29 years old, I can relate to this feeling of being lost in the world without the context by which to interpret it, but I don't think we need to abandon evangelicalism to find a sense of historic placement. In fact, I believe this thirst for rootedness can be fully satisfied within a Protestant and evangelical framework. You can be Catholic without becoming capital C Catholic. You can become Orthodox without becoming capital O Orthodox. As we promote gospel-centered ministry for the next generation, we must make clear there's nothing inconsistent with being both evangelical and ancient, gospel-centered and historically rooted. The reason is simple. Gospel-centeredness is itself historically rooted. In fact, it's as ancient as the gospel himself. So let's talk about evangelicals in the pre-Reformation church. How many Christians between the Apostle John and Martin Luther do you think today's average American evangelical can name? It seems we contemporary evangelicals have a tendency to neglect this plan of church history, this span of church history, acting as if the important stuff basically skipped from the first to the 16th century. All right, so he's basically saying what I opened up with. Yes, we acknowledge the importance of Augustine, especially his Confessions, which, by the way, was basically his autobiography. And there were some key battles about Christology and Trinitarianism early on, and some courageous martyrs somewhere back there, too. Sometimes we'll even enjoy a John Chrysostom sermon. I actually read a portion of one on Easter Sunday here at the church. Or a Bernard of Clairvaux poem. But all too often we give the impression that our real tradition is roughly 500 years old, with a few scattered precursors, perhaps, rather than one solid 2,000-year-old tradition. And there are huge sketches of time to... I need my glasses checked. There are huge stretches of time to which we have no conscious connection. What would it have been like to be a Christian in the 800s, or, for example? Did gospel-centeredness exist then? How does the ministry approach we champion today relate to the entire history of the church? If we contemporary Protestants have sometimes failed to explore these questions, it isn't an error we learn from the first Protestants, nor is it intrinsic to Protestantism. In fact, the Reformers took pains to emphasize they were seeking to reform the church, not recreate it, and that the true gospel had never entirely vanished from the earth. Even the most strident critics of Roman Catholic theology, like Luther or later Turretin, insisted that during seasons of great corruption and decadence, God had always preserved a regenerate people, though Luther, in typical tongue-in-cheek fashion, speculated that at times it had perhaps dwindled down to a few maidservants. And when Roman Catholic theologians appealed to Augustine and the church fathers to vindicate the tenets of the Counter-Reformation, Calvin didn't respond by saying, "Who cares what Augustine says? There's nothing. They're nothing." Instead, he became a diligent student of the church fathers, seeking to establish points of continuity between Reformation theology and patristic or church father theology. Sola Scriptura meant Scripture alone is the supreme authority, not that Scripture alone is valuable. Oh, I wish we could get our current-day Baptists to see this. Oh, I wish we could. I can't tell you how many years I was with people, around people, inundated with the idea that it doesn't matter what church history says. And that's precisely the attitude that concocted cults of all kinds in the 1800s in America alone. So owning the family photo album, I'm a Protestant. I believe Reformation theology protects the gospel, but I'm also I also believe it's possible to be robustly Protestant and vitally connected to, say, medieval Christianity. The church didn't completely sink during the eras of castles and cathedrals, monks and monasteries, bows and arrows, and knights in shining armor, only to suddenly reemerge with Luther's 95 Theses. No, there is a solid and steady chunk of Christianity subsisting right along Cædmon and Charlemagne and Chaucer, and since through many advances and retreats, corruptions and renewals, Jesus has always been building his church, we can stand to learn from medieval theology. Okay, so, brother, I'm with you. I am with you. So I'm going to skip the next three paragraphs because you're going to say what I'm thinking. That doesn't change the fact that the theory behind it and the biblical ecclesiology behind what you're saying doesn't assist us in finding these people. So he begins the next session and the final section. Where to begin? If we want to increase our awareness of our pre-Reformation roots, where should we begin? The first six chapters of Mark Knoll's Turning Points, Decisive Moments in the History of Christianity, serve a great starting point in terms of secondary literature. But let me here mention three primary texts. These are all classic works of theology I believe deserve a wider readership among contemporary Protestants. So here's Boethius. Let me spell that for you. Boethius. Boethius's a work called The Consolation of Philosophy. He gives three of them. This is the first one. Boethius's The Consolation of Philosophy. Despite being one of the most influential books throughout church history, this work has been almost forgotten in recent centuries. Of it, C.S. Lewis remarked, "Until about 200 years ago, it would, I think, have been hard to find an educated man in any European country who did not love it." Well, that's really saying something. Written in alternating poetry and prose while Boethius was awaiting execution in 524, this work explores themes of suffering and divine providence. His treatment of the classic difficulty, divine foreknowledge and human free will in Book 5 alone, makes the volume worth reading. Gregory the Great. He lived 540 to 604. He wrote a book called The Book of Pastoral Rule. Apparently, he's seen as by Calvin as the last good pope. This book is a classic of pastoral theology. Every minister should consider reading it. Gregory's thesis is that pastoral ministry requires a delicate balance of inner and outer qualities, theory and practice, contemplation and activity, administration and asceticism, otherworldly holiness and earthly wisdom. This is a helpful reminder since pastors tend to gravitate toward one of these realms more than the other. A good edition can be found in St. Vladimir Seminary's popular patristic series. And then third, Anselm's Proslogion. Although famous for its ontological argument for God's existence, this volume's rich theology and impassioned prayers make it a nourishing and edifying read as well. My doctrinal research concerns St. Anselm's doctrine of heaven in chapters 24 and 25, and my delight and amazement with this book is the chief cause of this article. If anyone doubts the value of reading pre-Reformation theology, all I can say is find a good translation of the first chapter of Proslogion and read on. So, this is good. It raises the question of whether or not you would consider yourself a student of church history. Seriously, let me just ask you a series of questions here, and let's see if you're following what I'm saying. Can you name a Christian of the Reformation besides Luther and Calvin? Okay. True or false? Erasmus, you know, the one that you say is responsible, many of you, for the Textus Receptus, not the Textus Receptus, the Textus, okay, if you want to call it Textus Receptus, go ahead. But the one responsible for the TR behind the King James Version of the Bible. Question, 1400s or 1500s? 1500s or 1600s? Can you put them on a timeline? Reformation or pre-Reformation? Can you put them on a timeline? I mean, that's pretty important, after all. We claim it, right? What three centuries would you find the Crusades in? What three centuries would you find those Crusades in? Do you know what the Crusades are? Were there true believers involved with the Crusades? These are difficult questions, but they're not impossible questions, and they're questions that Christians should be able to say they have some idea about. It's embarrassing enough that many of us know so little about our family history. But let it not be said that we know nothing of the faith of our fathers. That song we sing, Faith of Our Fathers Living Still in Spite of Dungeon, Fire, and Sword. Oh, how our hearts beat high with joy whenever we hear that glorious word. And many of us could not name seven key church history figures before John Rice. So I guess what I'm trying to say is you don't have to be an expert to know something. I mean, think about the discussions that can be had when you're out on the street and you're on a bus stop and you decide to discipline yourself and put down your phone and engage in a real, no kidding, personal conversation with someone in front of you. Can you imagine such a thing? Imagine asking them, have you ever read Anselm? And then you quote something to them. Now, think this through with me. I am all about being forthright, but we are commanded to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves in Matthew 10. Can you imagine quoting someone who believed the Bible and how much it takes the edge off of, hey, if you died today, would you go to heaven or hell? Let's be real frank. That works with some people, but not all. And it would be really nice if you had a couple of different tools that you could use to start talking with someone about eternal things. You might not get them to a gospel presentation on the first talk, but what if you have 5 or 6 minutes with someone on the bus and you say, I want to encourage you to think about a life that never ends. You know, just something short, something sincere. A question, something short, something sincere. Have you thought about your Creator today? They don't have to like you. They don't even have to answer you because the mere question puts God in their mind. It's an admonishment. Or, hey, have you ever read chapter 1 of Anselm's work, Proslogion? Have you read that? Have you ever read anything by Augustine? And if they say, who is that or what is that? So he was a Christian from the 400s. All of a sudden, we're not talking about American history, and we're not talking about white American history. We're not talking about white religion history. We're reaching way on back there in many cases to North African Christianity. Think about that. Think about that. Sometimes we're talking about Turkish Christianity. We're either talking about, in those cases, people with dark olive skin or black skin altogether. Think that through. And so all I'm trying to suggest to you is that maybe this is just another way that you can be used in the kingdom. Special thanks to Brother Ortland for this article. And this is Pastor Bill. Thanks for listening.